I was born in Las Vegas, Nevada, which is owned by the military. 98% of it is controlled by the military. And the nuclear test site, many people don't know, is right on the other side of Las Vegas. And when I was a young boy, at 12 o'clock in the afternoon every Saturday, the sirens would go off, and you could then feel the nuclear bomb go off, and the earth would turn into almost like an ocean. And, of course, having watched a lot of television, I always saw movies about nuclear power turning people into monsters and huge giants eating people. So I knew that something was wrong with nuclear power. And by the end of the 60s, I started participating in anti-nuclear movements. And part of this movement involved atomic soldiers, men who had been asked by the government to walk directly into the site of a nuclear explosion and to make holes in the ground, what they call foxholes, and then just cover their faces when the bomb would go off, not telling them that this level of radiation would eventually kill them all. And I worked in trying to get information about the government having known that they were going to kill people. And then I found out that the people in southern Utah, which is just north of Las Vegas, were what we call downwind victims. That is, when they would throw these bombs, they would wait for the wind to move into southern Utah, because there's a lot of Mormons there, and they believe, and the Mormons really believe what the government tells them, that the dust that is on their cars or on their children is just dust, just wash it off. So the cancer rates are very high. So we did get a hold of some secret documents showing that the government did know this, and we took it all the way to the Utah Supreme Court. And basically the Utah Supreme Court said that anything that the United States government does to its own civilian population for national security reasons is legal. The people cannot sue the government. So that meant that the testing on these human beings was legal, and it was done for national security reason. And that, to me, kind of destroyed a lot of naive elements of that world. But it did teach me about activism. At the same time, I became very interested in theater because I saw agitprop theater of Teatro Campesino, Bread and Puppet Theater, who did a lot of activist work. And because I was fascinated with the screen and film, I thought maybe I could create a new type of agitprop theater. Well, I ended up going to Florida State years later in Tallahassee, Florida, and where I had entered the dramaturgy. In the theater. But of course I was fascinated with all these other things outside of that sort of traditional dramaturgy. So after about a year they asked me to leave school, and I just started working locally at a lesbian bookstore where I actually did most of the reading or my education during the 80s. I also went to a lot of parties, you know, had a really good time, and eventually I met a group of people at these parties who wanted to do something in terms of developing new counter gestures against the Reagan regime that had emerged. So we started exploring different gestures, and some of this stuff was to be plagiarist of the Frankfurt School. You know, we were all reading Dorno, Horkheimer, Baudrillard, the Situationists, Freud, Nietzsche, you know, all the usual suspects. But we decided that we would cut and paste these things, and where somebody would say negative dialectics, we would put cyberspace or virtual, because William Gibson's cyberspace had emerged around 84. So we were trying to say, look, we're in the cultural frontier. We're not in the nexus of power, but we can create gestures which can influence the globe at large, and which I thought was a very sort of heroic thing to do. But what actually brought the ideas of what would become electronic civil disobedience to the foreground was the emergence of AIDS. By 85, 86, many of our friends began to die. And there had emerged in several cities in San Francisco and New York and others a movement called ACT UP, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. And through a series of events, we created an ACT UP Tallahassee. And we started doing direct action work on the streets. But what we noticed was that by the end of the 80s, We were doing much better actions. Our politics were much clearer. The information we've had was much better. It wasn't just anger, but we had clear messages. But the response of the media was not as focused as well. So Critical Art Ensemble, that's the name we gave ourselves, decided that maybe something else had shifted. We needed to develop a new sort of gesture for a new space, what we call cyberspace. We began to theorize that capital had now moved into this information space and had left the streets, and that the streets were dead, we said. So a new type of disobedience, a new type of resistance had to emerge, which was electronic. We had done some simple telephone jams, phone-ins, where we would call businesses to sell condoms, do actions, and we saw that these simple tools of fax jamming could leverage action. So we took the concept of Thoreau's civil disobedience, which has been a part of Gandhi, Martin Luther King, ACT UP, nonviolent direct action, let us say, and we put electronic in front of it. And this really kind of created a coherent new thought in Critical Art Ensemble of what electronic civil disobedience would be like in its general guidelines, how it would function through trespass and blockage, blocking information, moving information. But we weren't very sure in terms of the technology because the technology was not around. Only the metaphors were around. By 1991... I went to New York City because I began to hear that there were artists who had begun to put infrastructure together of this cyberspace. Among them was Wolfgang Stehle, a German conceptual artist from the 80s, who started The Thing in New York City in 1991 as a bulletin board system. And I went up to New York. I began to explain to him some concepts of electronic civil disobedience and political resistance. And he was quite fascinated with the idea. He said, "Ricardo, here's a bunch of computers. We can't teach you, but go ahead." So in early New York, I lived in squats. I just tried to integrate myself into the activist community. I also spoke to the activist community about electronic civil disobedience, but they were not very responsive. They weren't quite sure what that was. I then tried to make contact with the hackers at 2600, and they would go, "I don't know what that is, Ricardo. This doesn't sound very good." And one of the things that Critical Art Ensemble had said in their two early books, Electronic Disturbance and Electronic Civil Disobedience and Other Unpopular Ideas, they're both online, all the text. We said, look.
Let me just interrupt you. Do you have the URL for where they get them, or just where you could find the links for that?
I always recommend search engines for anything. If you put up in a search engine Critical Art Ensemble, it will take you there and you'll find links. If you put in search engine Electronic Disturbance Theater, it will take you. If you put in a term hacktivism, you will get some response. I can www.thing.net/RDOM for Ricardo Dominguez, and you'll find links there also. The Thing became a very important infrastructure for electronic civil disobedience, because that's one of the things that we discovered was that you need an ethical ISP, an infrastructure that will support political resistance, struggle, which is not easy to find. And what I discovered that indeed that when Critical Art Ensemble said, look, the activists will never use technology because it goes against the grain, a Luddite tradition of what technology means to the communities of the left. So you'll never convince them that it will be useful. To the hackers, they will never be politicized, and the streets are dead. So we kind of put ourselves in a very cynical, very harsh position. But I still felt the practice needed to happen. And I still had a sort of utopian hope that if you talk to people enough and discuss it and dialogue, something will emerge. Well, what did emerge was the Zapatistas. January 1st, 1994, as NAFTA, the huge economic bloc between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, had been born at that minute after midnight, they came down from the La Condona as a guerrilla group in southern Mexico, right next to Nicaragua. And they basically said, "Ya basta," to NAFTA. They said enough is enough to this neoliberalism that is taking over the globe. We in Chiapas are facing its death machine constantly. And so they created these autonomous zones. But what happened was that in those first 10 days of battle, where they were actually shooting each other, they broke into the electronic fabric. They didn't expect that the Zapatistas, I mean, they didn't make plans, we're going to become the dominant information war community online. They stepped into this electronic web because all of a sudden the first declaration of the La Condona, the speech that they made when they took over Chiapas, was that an email spread throughout the world. And suddenly, within those 10 days, bloomed an autonomous network of Zapatistas all over the planet. On January 2nd, I became part of the New York Zapatistas in New York, and we started doing real actions, hunger strikes. And you could see, because I was online, an electronic movement emerging and a real movement on the ground emerging, which to me showed that somehow the streets were not dead. That the networks could be highly politicized. And so the idea of creating hybrids between data bodies and real bodies, leveraging themselves, the Zapatistas really made that manifest. And they understood it in 10 days. That is, they came down from the mountain as a traditional leftist guerrilla troop following the arc of 20th century Latin American guerrilla groups ready to march, die, kill. But suddenly, they dropped their arms and they became an information war guerrilla movement or an info peace community where they used the leverage of the networks to bring their voice to a global community and really brought pressure on the Mexican government because the Mexican government within a few months was at the table talking to the Zapatistas, something that wouldn't, if you would look at the history of Latin American, would not happen. And it really transformed the Zapatistas, where they became, because of the networks, more Mayan than they had accepted in themselves. And really what they discovered is that the way these 28 Mayan communities, the democratic roots, and the way they process a dialogue suddenly became much more important in the way the networks had dialogues than this kind of armed struggle. So that suddenly words became war. And that's where the Zapatistas show that information war is still predominant. Text, email, is the predominant thing of hacktivism. That's where it was born. Not technology in terms of code or super flash or also encryption. It was simple email. And it's still hacktivism at its core is about email and exchange. And remember, the Zapatistas don't have computers. They don't even have electricity. Half the time, you know, they take a process of dialogue between Mayan dialects to Spanish, to English. It's a long arc. So that they became so fast in accepting it is truly amazing. We always say it's part of a Mayan technology that blossomed. So that by 1998, when Wired.com put out its 25 most important people online or groups, number one was Bill Gates, number two were the Zapatistas. So if you see the difference of infrastructure, of money, of connectivity, it shows that you don't have to have all the software. You don't have to be a technical genius to create a very powerful network tool because it's always about words. Words as war, no longer as words for war, which is the way intelligence and military communities believe these things to be. Well, in response to an Akhtial massacre on December 22nd, 1997, there was a worldwide Zapatista response to these paramilitary troops killing 45 women and children when the police were only like 500 feet away. And the weapons that were used were U.S. drug war weapons. So I felt that something needed to be done beyond communication and documentation, which was the network. We needed to really push nonviolent direct action, add a new element to the paradigm, communication primary, documentation secondary, third, activism or action. So what happened is that I received an email from an Italian group called the Anonymous Digital Coalition, who had already been doing net strikes, an earlier one in support of the Zapatistas, and the earliest one in 95 against the French nuclear plant. They were building a new nuclear plant, and they did a successful net strike. So because of translation problems, I had not heard of it. But finally we connected, and I said, that is a fantastico idea. And basically what it was every browser has a refresh or reload button. And what happens is when you hit that button, it goes to the server that you're requesting a URL from, and it says, you know, knock, knock, open. It opens the door and says yes, and goes, can I have this page? The server says, certainly. It gives it to you. It comes down on your browser. And basically, the more you hit reload, refresh, the more times you're going to request that page. So they said, let's go to Mexican President Zedillo's website between 1 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Mexico City time, and we all hit refresh, reload over and over, over and over, over and over, every 3 seconds, however fast you can do it, you know. And this should, in theory, create a disturbance on the site. I said, you know, this is fantastical, let's do it. A few minutes later, I received an email from a net artist named Brett Stahlbaum at Cadre in San Jose, California. He said, Ricardo, I've read some of your material, and I think I can create a little applet that will create like a meta refresh of hitting the URL over and over and over. That way we don't have to hurt our fingers, and it will take into account how many people join, which will even create a greater digital presence of bodies there. I said, you know, please do this. Carmen Karasik at MIT, a Boston net artist who I had worked with previously on another Zapatista network project, said, I want to create an electronic monument for the Octial dead. Can you give me the names? And I said, you know, this is a great idea. Let me introduce you to Brett. He's interested in doing this applet. He doesn't want to design the skin or the look. Maybe you guys can get together and make an active skin. At the same time, I had been in communication with the Austin, Texas digital Zapatistas, Dr. Harry Cleaver, Tamara Ford, and another information war specialist. He had done his thesis on information war, drug war, and Mexico that I had read. His name is Stefan Ray, a theorist and longtime activist. And it just so happened that he had just entered the doctoral program at NYU. And he came basically through the doors as all of this was happening. And he said, I want to do my dissertation on electronic civil disobedience in theory and practice and take it beyond critical art ensemble. I said, Stefan, let's work together on an infrawar list. Because I think something is happening. Electronic civil disobedience will be put into practice. Indeed, Carmen and Brett gave me the Zapatista Floodnet. A week later, we made a call for everybody to participate. We did a virtual sit-in on President Zedillo's website. 18,000 people came in 2 hours. Many people got a response from this website saying, too many people are requesting this page, please come back later. The next day, we were in the New York Times, and basically international hacktivism was really born. And what hacktivism means for us is that we are transparent. We don't hide who we are. We make a deep connection between our data bodies and our real bodies. When I'm online, I say, I'm Ricardo Dominguez. I'm going to do this action on you at this time. I'm not going to crack into your server. I'm not going to change your web page. I'm just going to allow a space to emerge in which the weight of the community in protest will be sensed. In the same way a real sit-in in a building doesn't destroy the doors, doesn't destroy the windows, but it's going to be hard for you to go to the bathroom, get outside, for your car to move. The more people come, it just slows down the temporal condition and brings to the foreground the political condition. Because ultimately, hacktivism is not about the technology that is being used. It's not about the actual effect of a server either going down or crashing, but about a sociological drama that allows people to focus on an issue and leverage this little agitprop tool like a big puppet to focus everybody on an issue. And because the internet is such a hot medium right now, if you do anything online, everybody's going to get you media. So at this point, the arc of media attention can be very useful to activists in terms of focusing that sort of process. And there can be many different forms of hacktivism. Can be creating infrastructure for people to get email locally on the street, just making a little LAN for them. It can be making web pages, can be independent media. It's an empty term, hacktivism. So right now it's very energetic. It can be building new software that disallows people from being censored, like the Cult of the Dead Cow is creating right now for communist Chinese communities, or any community that wants a browser that, you know, doesn't filter what you're doing, who you're with. And I think these kind of anti-censorship tools are very important. So there's all sorts of levels that have occurred. And ultimately, what hacktivism, I think its most important element is that it's creating a dialogue between activists who have a lot of long-term, deep knowledge of the political conditions and the best way to develop long-term strategy. Hackers who are actually now being politicized, I never believed it was going to happen, who are now becoming interested in having a dialogue about the real world. At the recent 2600 conference in New York, they had actual sections in the conference on electronic civil disobedience, on hacktivism, and we weren't discussing software, we weren't discussing new tools or code, we were discussing political issues. We were reading Thoreau's On Civil Disobedience as a Hacker Manual of 1848. So, and some of these hackers actually went to actions against the Republican Convention in Philadelphia and, you know, got their ass busted. And so there was a beginning to have a dialogue. And I think that's why the Lufthansa action is very important, because it brings many communities of longtime activists working on the streets, doing deep political work, with some of the younger hacker politicized community, and I think a dialogue has opened. Because we can't develop a good critique or a good response without having some practice where both sides can kind of come to an understanding. The element that is difficult for hackers to understand is that the technology doesn't have to be efficient, because it's not about it being an efficient technology. It has to have symbolic efficacy. It has to create a massive symbolism and not a technological efficiency. Any hacker can create one tool that can destroy, you know, yahoo.com for a day or whatever, but that's the voice of one person. What you want are tools that create a response of a mass community in terms of how we see EDT, electronic civil disobedience. Tools have to be transparent, code has to be shared, connection between data bodies and real bodies, a sense of the sociological content being predominant. That is, what the information is should be the first thing. It doesn't, you know, it's if in the first paragraph it says, oh, it's about this applet versus it's about deportation, you know, then you know you have to shift your tactics. The main thing should be what the action is about. And underlying is the other element of the technological factor. So we've had lots of new hacktivist cells emerge since 99, since we gave away the Disturbance Developers Kit. There's Federation of Random Action in France. There is the UK Electro-Hippies who did the WTO action. There's S11 who did the Melbourne DNS hijack of Nike. So you go to www.nike.com and you end up in sweatshop, anti-sweatshop sites. So you will see different forms of hacktivism. There's been hackers who got into Davos data banks and got the names of Clinton and their credit cards, didn't do anything with it other than burn it and send it to the publishers and say, look, because as their walls start getting harder, we have to find other ways of disturbing that. So, you know, even though EDT doesn't necessarily use specific technological hacker methods, it's not that we don't see within hacking possibilities of hacktivism, and that we see within street activisms also symbolic hacktivism and cultural hacktivism into the streets. And anyway, please push forward, and thank you.
Yeah, you have to get off to Cologne now. Just one more minute to give us the details about this online demo. Could you please give us the date and the time where we could find more information about this anti-deportation online demo against Lufthansa?
Yeah, it's going to happen on June 20th as a real action is happening in front of the shareholders meeting of Lufthansa. And the URL where you can go and in the probably about 5 or 6 days download the virtual sit-in technology. It's at http /go.to/online-demo.